Connected live. Catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.
Goodness, what a weekend it's been for Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, who was at the Oval Office. And we all saw how that meeting went down with the president of the United States, Donald Trump. On the line with us is director of research at OWL Social Economic Research Institute, Angelo Fick. Thank you so much once again for making time for us. Angelo, good evening and welcome.
Good evening to you and to your listeners, and apologies for my tech problems earlier.
Oh, thank you so much for coming through eventually. Angela, what did you make of what we saw at the Oval Office?
Well, I think it's just, you know, another day in the new administration of the United States in its current phase of politics. And while it was indeed jarring, it is of the same substance as we've seen in earlier moments between, you know, the media conference in which Mr. Trump and Mr. Musk were sitting in the office with Mr. Musk's child present, and that interaction. And while we don't have live footage of it or even recorded footage of it, the reports of what had happened between the Danish Prime Minister and the American president around Greenland. That apparently was an equally contentious and very unpleasant telephone call. So my sense is that the policy uncertainty is the consequence of these kinds of interactions with things that are not just Mr. Trump himself, but people around him behaving in ways that are not, normal in or not as part of the general pattern of international relations between heads of state.
So obviously after that, Zelensky went off to London, you know, to a very warm welcome there. And you could see immediately after that meeting, tweets coming from leaders in Europe, you know, showing some solidarity and support. Is this, in a way, one of the things that's going to bring the UK and Europe closer after Brexit?
That is possible. So we know that there have been shifts in British policy towards Europe under Keir Starmer. And the concerns have been that Keir Starmer's relationship with the desire under Keir Starmer's leadership for the UK to continue the so-called special relationship with the United States have raised concerns among people who felt that Keir Starmer's mandate was a little further to the left than where the United States was heading. Whether or not this results in a different defense policy for the European Union remains to be seen. We've heard from Mr. Macron, we've heard from the Polish Prime Minister that there's certainly going to be a new set of priorities around making European self-defense independent of American presence in that defense mechanism, which is currently the case in NATO. How that rolls out, of course, will have consequences across Europe for if the proposal is to have a greater spend of GDP and of budget on defense from what is average 2% to 5%, what that will mean across an already rightward swinging European polity where voters are swinging further to the right.
And I mean, that would probably mean doubling up on that spend immediately.
Possibly, and that spend would then have to come from somewhere else. And whether that then, you know, further renders people renders people more precarious from where they currently are, particularly in the poorer countries in the European Union. And I mean, that sounds odd to say it from South Africa. But if one is in the European South, for example, in places like Italy, if there is a greater spend on defense, because the way in which Russia's posturing in relation to Europe, and particularly not just over Ukraine, but other forms of dependence that the Europeans, the Western Europeans, have on Ukraine and Russia, for example, for energy, may shift the way in which Europe then has to posture in relation to the United States. And this may be the beginning of the end of the Atlanticism that we've seen in the post-1945 period. And it may actually be a realignment in NATO, which Mr. Trump has been speaking of himself as a problem, often counterfactually talking about the ways in which America carries a financial burden in NATO. And so the treatment of allies in the North Atlantic Treaty Organization alliance, even immediate neighbors like Canada, has suddenly raised concerns about the ongoing stability of NATO you know, the purpose of which ceased to be what it was under the Cold War, and a rearticulation of a certain kind of American imperialism of the 1990s through NATO, and now the European partners finding that they themselves are they can be sacrificed under this Trump administration's revision of what the American mandate is.
So if we speak directly to Zelensky and his survival through all of this, you're already starting to see direct attacks to his presidency, where, you know, people around Trump are calling for his removal in a way. And I don't know what that actually means, but, you know, maybe somebody else must come here and maybe we can start talking. This guy's not serious, Trump tweeted this afternoon. What do you think it means for him domestically in Ukraine? And I do gather there was obviously lots of support after that Oval Office meeting. But politically, what do you think it means for him?
So, you know, the information that's being put about by figures in the Trump administration about President Zelensky's so-called unpopularity, or the fact that he is a dictator, or even counterfactually stating who had begun the belligerence between Ukraine and Russia, and suggesting that Russia was not the aggressor. All of those, I think, have sent alarm bells across the European sphere, because they are much closer to the conflict zone and therefore are likely to pay an immediate price. Mr. Zelensky himself, I think, his popularity across Europe has risen. We've seen this in direct support of, among other things, 1.6 billion euros being pledged by Keir Starmer from the United Kingdom, support being pledged by Poland. And so my sense is that the European experience of the Cold War will have made them very, very anxious about military posturing to their east. But the irony is, this is, of course, also the consequence of NATO's military posturing in the wake of the unbundling of the Soviet Empire in the 1990s, and moving the NATO barrier closer and closer to Russia. So there is a new world order emerging, and in that world order, the posturing about by the premier political and the premier economic and military power on the planet, the United States of America, there are two arenas at work here. One is Ukraine, but the other one, of course, is the entire Middle East, and the way in which those two are linked, I think, is confronting European states with very, very stark choices about how they're going to proceed, because their position on the conflict in Palestine was often very different from their position on the conflict in Ukraine.
Yeah, of course. So let's talk about the US and Trump. And while you saw immediately rallied support for Zelensky after that Oval Office meeting, and you could see also with the pledges, as you've just mentioned, there wasn't actual direct condemnation of the US and Trump. So, you know, there was a very gentle way of going around not saying Trump was a bully directly. These world leaders were very careful not to say that. In fact, Starmer today was also quite careful to say we cannot do it without the support of the US. What do you make of that diplomatic language?
So we've certainly heard from figures like Starmer in the United Kingdom, this kind of soft soaping. But we've also heard from figures like Macron in France, who wants to take a more De Gaullist approach. Yeah. Remember, De Gaulle pulled France out of the NATO alliance in the 60s, and suggested that perhaps it was time for Europe to consider a nuclear deterrent in relation to the rising threat that they perceive in Russia. The ways in which Western Europe is, you know, integrally tied into the United States, not just economically, but also politically, and in so many other ways culturally, will explain some of the soft soaping that we've seen from the United Kingdom. But they also rail politic. You know, this remains still one of the most powerful states economically, and certainly the most powerful state militarily. And because Europe's defense has been so integrally related to the American defense industry, at least since 1945, since 1950, it isn't going to be easy for these states to go it alone. They haven't, many of those states have themselves demilitarized. One thinks of places like Sweden and Denmark. And peacetime Europe has certainly experienced a very different sense of safety and security, which the last 20 years have made them very much more vulnerable and dependent on the United States as the you know, the sort of the bully in the background that could back up any defense that they had. And with the United States' shift in our stand with Russia, the Europeans have suddenly found themselves very much left out in the cold and having to very quickly scramble to think of how they're going to go about constructing defense against, you know, any kind of Russian aggression, should there be any such, without an American backer. As for the United States, again, this is not just about the individual administrations of these states, but it's also about the people who are likely to benefit from a wider war. And Europeans will certainly be dependent on weapons manufacturers who I think are very eager to have these kinds of conflicts because there's money to be made from war. And so the £1.6 billion that are being promised to the Ukraine may come from British taxpayers, but they're certainly not going to go directly only to Ukrainians. They're going to go to Western weapons manufacturers who are likely to benefit very much from any kind of conflict and its escalation.
And by the way, to your point exactly, not to be fooled by the fact that just because Trump, you know, says, I want peace, it doesn't mean that the Americans' arms industry is not going to benefit. Because as you said, you know, this industry is quite integrated across the oceans. And so there will be that kind of a benefit by U.S. companies who, whatever, you know, the political position is, are going to benefit from the war continuing.
Absolutely. And we've seen the consequences of this in Palestine, where European citizens may often have made remarks to their governments and governments may have postured about the ways in which they were going to oppose Israeli aggression in Gaza. And yet very many investigators have found that there were components for aircraft, components for weapons guidance systems that have their origins across a variety of states that at the official policy were not embroiled in the conflict, but were certainly part and parcel to the war, because what we saw on the ground in Gaza were components that had their origins in states in the European Union and often, you know, in those weapons manufacturers that are, as you've pointed out, transnational and no longer just tied into one political entity or state.
So I mean, it may take a while, but with Trump being in office now and maybe for, you know, for his entire term, what do you think politically is this is going to mean for the U.S.? And you know, you've obviously pointed out the fact that they are quite powerful and, you know, big economy and all of that. But there really is quite a shift. We've only been in it for, what, a month and a little bit. And he's done quite a lot to position himself, the U.S., quite differently to where we've seen and quite rapidly. What do you think this means for the U.S. maybe 10, 15 years from now?
So it's very difficult to predict what 15 years from now is going to look like, given how quickly we've gone from January 21 to February 28 and now even March 3rd. But, you know, observers and particularly economists in the United States are very much concerned about the shrinking economy in an American economy that is already vaguely troubled in all sorts of ways around inequities and the kinds of inequalities in that American economy. And so while we've seen great growth in the wealth of the wealthiest elites, the billionaire and the multi-billionaires, you know, the gutting of the civil service equivalent federal employees in the United States have had grave consequences for, you know, thousands upon thousands of people whose lives have been shaken. And we've seen this in the responses in smaller towns and town halls where Republican senators going from town to town have often had to flee the safe spaces they're in because they're being challenged by people who often voted or supported them, veterans in the military. There's also been responses from establishments like the United States military indicating to, for example, trans soldiers and combatants that they may have to separate themselves from the military before a date in March, before all of their data becomes public and they may be forced out. So there are all sorts of internal concerns that the United States as a polity has to deal with. And what many sort of see coming out of this chaos is increasingly an isolationist position by the United States that takes it back to the Monroe Doctrine of the 19th century. Let's not forget that in both wars, the World War I and World War II, the American state was a very late entry into the war because while it continued to supply weapons in the early phases of both the First and the Second World War, it only became an active combatant very late in the First World War and only when it was attacked by Japan in the Second World War. And so that isolationism will be a change. But how this affects global policy is or global, what the consequence of this will be in territories outside the United States will be severe. So we've already seen the consequences for health around the world, because a lot of the funding coming out of the United States was about building a global health infrastructure. And this kind of isolationism will certainly see a return of all sorts of communicable and infectious diseases. And if you tie that in with the climate catastrophe unfolding and the United States' own challenge of maintaining disease as science and health infrastructure is being dismantled by people who've had to reverse their positions, even, you know, the Secretary for the Secretary of State responsible for the health issues, Robert Kennedy Jr., has himself had to reverse his position on the measles outbreak. So what this looks like 15 years from now is very difficult, because I remember living through the unbundling of the Soviet Union and the change in Eastern Europe. And in 1990, you could not have predicted what Europe would look like in 2004. The idea that Poland would be inside the European Union, that Romania would join the EU, that NATO would expand, that all sorts of countries that existed then would no longer exist now, so that they would no longer be Czechoslovakia or Yugoslavia, but they would be broken up into various. So it's very difficult to predict, but these internal stability of the United States is certainly a question. And some observers have even gone so far as to say that they may be facing a second civil war if the unhappy and, you know, distressed people who had voted for Mr. Trump continue to experience the exigencies of his policy decisions just from the last 20 to 30 days.
And to your point about the fact that we are actually seeing those who are surprised by his supporters, who are surprised by, you know, his actions. And you spoke about, you know, the town halls that are quite vocal about their disappointment. We've seen job cuts, a lot of civil servants who are absolutely shocked about what's happening, but people who supported him initially, Hispanics and so on. I'm surprised, and I mean, maybe explain to me, why do we think or see the Democrats being, I don't know, maybe for me, mute and not taking advantage of a moment like this and rising from the ashes?
So the assumption that the Democratic Party is somehow sort of to the left of what is going on has long been questioned by people like Noam Chomsky and various other observers. Because what the consensus by critics of the American bipartisan system has always been is that one party will do something under the table and the other party will do it alone. And so what the Republicans are now doing is simply they're saying out loud what the Democrats have been practicing on the quiet for a very long time. So people look back nostalgically at the Biden presidency and they look back even more nostalgically to the Barack Obama presidency. But they forget that depending on where in the world you sat, the Obama presidency was not at all progressive. So the way in which the Obama presidency responded to the global financial crisis by bailing out bankers did not build greater equality in the United States. On the contrary, the elites made a killing during that particular period. If you were, you know, children in Southwest Asia, in places like Pakistan or Afghanistan, the expansion of extraordinary rendition, the expansion of drone warfare, the extrajudicial killings that happened across places like Pakistan and Afghanistan in the so-called war on terror was actually expanded under Mr. Obama after he won the Nobel Peace Prize than it had been under both of the, you know, Bush Jr. presidencies. So I think, you know, we have to be careful to look at the current moment and its crises, and it is a crisis. And it's a crisis in which the global empire of the United States, you know, when things happen in the center, they shake on the periphery as well. Is seen as some kind of perversion. We didn't get here by accident or just by one election. And internal critics of the United States, sitting inside the United States, have long indicated that the dismantling of public education, the deregulation of information distribution systems through mass media, the, you know, concerns around how people consume and get information about the world they're in, has for more than two generations been a problem in the United States. And so it was inevitable that you could have this kind of people voting against their own interests because they have very limited information that is meaningful about the world they live in. And their decisions are informed often by, in the past, a lack of information, and suddenly over the last 15 years, active disinformation. It was, after all, the United States' lie at the United Nations that led to the invasion of Iraq, as if Iraq had been responsible for the 9/11 events. It was the carpet bombing of Afghanistan, you know, the ousting of the Taliban and the ignominious withdrawal from Afghanistan by the United States and its allies that echoed the United States' military failures in Vietnam in the 70s. And so this is not some kind of aberration in the United States' politics. This politics has always been there. It is now simply done in a more vulgar way, in a way that isn't as nicely finessed as it would have been under the Democrats.
So where does that leave the American public? You know, do you think they're just going to ride it out for the next 4 years?
I don't think that that's necessarily the case. Remember, they have so-called midterm elections that are coming up at some point.
Yeah.
And my suspicion is also that there is active resistance already building. So figures like Timothy Snyder and various others are talking about how do you construct resistance to tyranny. Bernie Sanders is getting packed halls when he's talking, attracting crowds who normally would not have gone to either a Democratic rally or even to a Bernie Sanders talk had they been Democratic supporters. We've seen political figures and people inside the judicial system at the state level in places like California and elsewhere beginning to construct forms of resistance. But again, if one goes back to the 19th century American philosophers, people like Henry David Thoreau, the position is that you can very easily vote in tyranny, but you can't vote tyranny out. And how the United States gets out of this particular phase, and it's not just the tyranny of one man, it's the tyranny of a class of people. Of billionaires that include Peter Thiel, you know, Elon Musk and various other people. How they get beyond this phase is going to be a challenge for them. And the historical record is not inspirational for this happening without an immense amount of violence and at a huge cost to human lives. You know, revolutions, resistance to tyranny is not something that comes without great violence. The American Civil War of the 1860s was certainly one that had a huge cost and left a deep wound in the American body politic. And in other parts of the world, similar kinds of resistances to the rise of tyranny, it takes generations to recover from. And in some senses, you never fully recover. If you just look at the current dynamics in the German state, these kinds of things don't easily go away. And so you would think 80 years after Germany had gone down this road, how does one explain the rise of the Alternative für Deutschland movement? In a state that, to all intents and purposes, was very comfortable, had been denazified partially, not completely, and yet there's a return of this. And so, you know, it's easy to feel schadenfreude about the dynamics inside the United States, but people must remember that we now live in a world in which the consequences can be planetary, because this is now the most powerful military state with nuclear weapons that can wipe out all life on Earth. In one fell swoop. And so schadenfreude might feel good in the moment, but we should have great concern, because all our lives are at stake if things go horribly wrong inside the United States.
Gosh.
And it threatens life as we know it.
What a way to end it. Thank you for that reflection, Angela Fick. Really appreciate your time. Director of Research at OWL Social Economic Research Institute. I don't know how that leaves me. I am feeling quite uncomfortable at the moment, and it's quite a way to think of it. And we've seen it over the weekend, guys. I mean, you saw what kind of a temperament Donald Trump has, and J.D. Vance. It's quite scary. All right, let me take your calls, 086-000-0959. Let me know what you made of that conversation in the Oval Office over the weekend, and I'll also very happily listen to those voice notes, 063-688-0959.
If you missed it live, catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.